Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. Got Ellen Brown back today. Everybody knows Ellen. She wrote the incredible book that knocked my socks off when I read it. I started reading it, and it's got so much information in it. It's called Web of Death. So much information in it. Sometimes you start reading a book and you say, well, you know, I'll read a little bit of this and let me just get the flavor of it. Once I started reading it, I couldn't put it down. Well, I couldn't finish it in one gulp, but I absolutely had to go from one chapter to the next and finish it, because it really is such an extraordinary book. It truly is a classic, and the same holds for all the articles that Ellen writes all the time. And she's got two new ones in the past few days that we just have to discuss on this program, and they fit right in with what's going on across America now, across the world. Opposition to the power of money in private hands. You're going to hear it again and again on this program. People don't know that's what they're protesting against. You know, they're mad about unemployment, and they're mad about losing their homes, and they sure don't like bankers, and they say so. But I wonder how many really understand exactly what, I know they don't know what the heck bankers do and how they make all their money, except, you know, the rudimentary stuff. You know, they steal and they do this and they do that. Well, that's not good enough. How do they do it? How do they rig the system so that they can commit massive fraud and get away with it? How do they rig it so they can speculate, run a casino operation, produce all kinds of toxic derivatives and other assets and pawn them off on people, and they simply don't know what's going on? I mean, how do they do all this aside from just saying they rob and they pillage and they cheat and, you know, they took my home away? Well, all that is true, but how is the most important thing? And it all comes down to the bottom line, and the bottom line is money power in private hands to make more of it for them at our expense. And the solution, it's not rocket science. It's featured in Ellen's book. It's featured in the articles that we'll talk about today. It comes right down to another bottom line. And every time it's been tried, in more recent times and in more past times, centuries past, money power in public hands does what money power is supposed to do. It lifts all boats together equitably. Ellen, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Stephen. You say the nicest things. That was actually my goal, you know, to do a page turner. In fact, I'm really a writer, as Michael Whitney says, he's a writer in search of a subject. You know, all my training's really in writing.
Oh,
well,
Web of Debt is a page turner. It's a big book, and unless you're a speed reader, which I am not, you can't swallow it in one gulp. But absolutely, Ellen. Once I started reading the book, I said I've got to read the whole thing. I mean, the more of this stuff I read, you know, it's like Fritos. The more you eat, the more you want. Well, I want nothing to do with Fritos, but I sure recommend Web of Debt. And your two articles today, well, the ones we'll talk about today, on how public banking helped lift Germany out of the ravages of World War II and helped them for decades afterwards. And also,
and you never hear about it.
You never hear a word about it.
That's why it's so interesting to research it, because you never learned that stuff. They never told you that in school because they didn't know. I mean, your teachers didn't know. And in fact, you could argue that even bankers, well, I just read this, bankers themselves, they'll tell you they don't create money because they don't know it either. It's the whole process has been so obscured in hundreds of years of making it more complicated that even bankers can't tell. I mean, even when they started out doing it, you know, it was fractional reserve lending where they were basically holding people's gold for safekeeping before they were even bankers. And then they'd give these little paper receipts for the gold. And everybody liked the receipts better than the gold because the gold was too heavy and you could get robbed. And if you stored it in your house, you could get robbed. So, and the paper receipts were secure and you had a little accounting entry and you knew how much you had. So then the banks discovered that they could lend. Other people would want to borrow the gold, and the banks discovered that they could lend these paper notes, and that they were, that people liked the paper notes better for borrowing as well. So then they discovered that they could issue a lot more notes than they had gold, but they weren't really thinking of it as creating money. They were really just thinking of making a profit. You know, here they were holding this gold and people wanted to borrow it and they would say sure, and they discovered that they could do that like about 10 times over and nobody really noticed. And then it became, got more sophisticated where instead of being gold, it was just the paper receipts, and then it became checkbook entries. And there you didn't even have the gold, or, I mean, the checkbook, the checks could be cashed in for gold. But all that stuff could be accounting entries between banks where you didn't even have the paper receipts. So it's not like you had a thing that you could track from here to there. Like, we've got 10 of these things, so we better hold 10% back because that's how many we'll need for people who come for them. It was all just numbers on checks. And in fact, the reason they invented checks was to get around a rule that was in, during the Civil War when the National Bank Act came down, and it required the state banks to pay a hefty tax on their banknotes, like 10%. The idea was to get everybody to be a national bank. They were trying to force everybody into this mold. And the state banks rebelled, of course, as states will do, and quit issuing their paper banknotes, or they issued fewer of them, and instead they just used these checks. We're just transferring numbers between accounts. But you can see where that got so obscure that nobody can really see that they're creating money here.
Oh, the bankers. The bankers are so devious, Ellen. And I remember, I believe that, I know you've said it, and I think you said it on this program, and I believe it's in Web of Dead, where you said, of course, the Federal Reserve Act 1913, it wasn't that gave the bankers power, more power than they ever had before, but bankers were evil and had plenty of power all the way back to the beginning of the Republic. I mean, why else would Jefferson rail about bankers and call them more dangerous than standing armies? I mean, that was over 200 years ago. And Andrew Jackson calling the Bank of the United States the closest equivalent to the Fed today, a hydra-headed monster. And he refused to renew the charter. Imagine if a president today could refuse to renew the Federal Reserve's charter. How many days do you think it'd last, Ellen, before the vice president would replace him after mourning at his funeral?
Yeah, well, you know, the last president that tried it, and not even as blatantly as Andrew Jackson, was John F. Kennedy. He was always at loggerheads with the Fed. He went down.
He went down for a lot of reasons. I've written about Kennedy. I mentioned him in my book, but I wrote an article about Kennedy once. Oh my goodness, it was over a year ago now. And I was motivated to do it because he was my commencement speaker. And I couldn't remember what he said, and I found his talk that went back to 1956 when he was a senator, and I read his talk, and I said, oh my God, politicians don't talk that way today. It was a marvelous talk. It was erudite. It was just a beautiful, beautiful talk. And it didn't sound like something a speechwriter could write. Maybe somebody helped him a little bit with it, but basically it sounded like something that the thoughts, if the final crafting wasn't done by somebody else, the thoughts were definitely his. And I don't know if senators have AIDS. Maybe they have speechwriters too. I don't know what they had in the 1950s, but it really sounded like something that came from a scholar, not a politician. And I said, I want to write about this. So I wrote about him, and I also wrote about the possible reasons why he was killed. Certainly his antagonism to the bankers, Ellen, but there were so many other reasons, too.
Yeah, I know.
He didn't want a second Bay of Pigs in Cuba.
Right,
the big
right.
reason for me was that he even though he sent troops to Vietnam at first, he wanted them out. He wanted America's involvement there ended.
Uh-huh.
And don't forget, I mean, he was killed in 1963 before the war really got legs. And he wanted those troops out. I think that was the main reason. He also hated the CIA, and he was very upset with what Israel was doing back then. He wanted what they were doing investigated. Israel was very, very unhappy with Kennedy, and there were people who believe, he wanted Palestinians to have the right of return. That's impossible for a president today. He wanted Palestinians to have refugees, to have the right of return. Well, Israel despised him, and there are people who believe that the Israeli Mossad, their CIA, were the ones who killed Kennedy. Who knows? They've certainly killed an awful lot of other people around the world, but we're straying from the subject.
Yeah.
The comment I wanted to make when I diverged on was that you have said that if members of Congress who voted for the Federal Reserve Act read it, they wouldn't have understood what they were voting for, because the language was vague, obscure, and the bankers disguised what they wanted to do very well. So unless you really study
this stuff. You still can't understand it. I mean, I've read it, and I'm a lawyer. I should be able to understand it, but it's really, really obscure.
So only the people who knew what they wanted and the way to get it understood what the heck they were talking about. But even a lawyer like you can read it and not realize what they were up to. If you just read the document, Ellen, with no mention of the Federal Reserve Act, you really would be in the dark, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, and it would be so boring you wouldn't do it. I mean, I think that's another thing. All legislation is so incredibly boring that you always go to the secondary sources. You don't want to read the thing itself. Those 3,000-page documents, I mean, today, I guess. But the Federal Reserve Act, William Jennings Bryan was the principal. He led the opposition to it, and originally when it was the Aldrich Act and it was obvious that it was Wall Street, he said absolutely not. There was no way he would approve a bill where Wall Street would be printing our money and lending it to us. And so they changed it so that you couldn't tell that was what was happening, and he got all excited, and he said, at last, the U.S. government will be printing its own money. But that's not what happened. They print it, but it's not their money. It's not U.S. notes.
It referred to coining money, and back then you could refer to coining money meaning only coins, as opposed to printing money.
Yeah, that's all they've got left, the coins. But that is actually, you know, I wrote that in Web of Debt, just as I had read that some head of the Bureau of Coins, I don't remember what you call that department, said at one in the 80s, he said that the government could solve its debt problem by just minting some large coins, that there's no limit on how many coins they can make, and there's no limit on the face value of the coin. So today, for example, you could stamp out 15 $1 trillion coins, and you'd take care of the debt, and you'd have a little money left over. And a number of economists actually picked up on that, and there's this whole discussion out there now about how you could solve the problem with some $1 trillion coins, which you would then put in the government's bank account, basically. So you don't actually ever spend the coins, but then you can draw against them, and it's a way to create money without having to go through the whole trouble of, you know, the Need Act, which is this Kucinich bill, would have all the Federal Reserve notes recalled, and then you'd print up U.S. dollars, U.S. notes, and replace them. But, you know, there's Federal Reserve notes all over the world. That would be difficult at best. Plus, most money isn't in the form of notes at all. It's in accounting entry money. But anyway, if you use the coins and just put them in the federal bank account, you can still call them Federal Reserve notes and borrow against them.
You know, that really is very interesting. If it's very, very tough getting change through the front door, then just go through the back door or the side window.
Yeah, it's already legal. You don't have to change a single thing, not one single law.
Oh, that would be marvelous. Of course, the only problem with a Kucinich bill or any other one like it is getting enough members of Congress to vote for it.
Oh, well, I don't actually agree with the Kucinich bill. I'm saying the coinage idea would work. The Kucinich bill has other things that I don't think would work. They want 100% reserves for banks. Well, that's fine for private banks if you want to do it. But you got to have a credit mechanism, so you really need banks that... All of our money today is created by banks. If you stop them from creating money, you're going to absolutely contract the money supply. Now, in the Kucinich bill, the plan is that you'll have this body at the top, which is like the Federal Reserve, which will decide how much money we need, and then it will print the money and hand it over to Congress, and Congress will spend it on infrastructure and different things, and supposedly it will trickle, find its way into the banks somehow, and then the banks will kindly just lend this on, although they don't get to get anything out of it except some service charges, and yet they're still supposed to be private. I mean, they're just not going to do it. They're not going to make any money doing it that way. So if you had that system, you would have to have public entities that, like post offices that are just doing this as a service, which would be fine. I think that would work fine. But you're going to have a big network of banks. It seems to me that... And I think they'd have to be public banks, because I don't think private banks will do it. They're not going to be able to, under the Kucinich bill, the private banks have to borrow, I mean, as they get their loans in, they have to borrow that sum from the Fed, or from this body that creates money. But they've already borrowed all the money that they're of the backing their outstanding loans. I mean, that's the way the whole check clearing thing works. Anyway, I think it's a misconception of how the money system works, and I don't think it would work myself. But.
Well, you and I support public banking. I absolutely think that is the answer by hook or by crook. Some way has to be found to get it, no matter how long it takes. And I thought your article on public banking in Germany was absolutely fascinating, because I didn't know anything about that. Talk about... what Germany did after World War II, and then bring it up to date as the private bankers and the IMF go after them to take away a good system so they can continue their limitless schemes of fraud and the rest of it. But it's incredible that Germany could do so well. Explain that to listeners. It was an eye-opener for me to read that article.
Yeah, it was an eye-opener for me to read it, to research it. Well, I was just in Germany and Switzerland, and so I heard something about the banks, particularly the Vier Bank, which is really interesting. It's a community currency, but it's big, really big. So anyway, the economy had collapsed, of course, after World War II. At first it collapsed after World War I, and then Hitler got the country back on its feet by just issuing money. Well, there's a lot of researchers say that this was actually what precipitated World War II, because the international bankers couldn't have that. It was demonstrating that a government could be self-sufficient and didn't need to borrow from the international bankers. Anyway, so Germany was flattened again after World War II, so instead of actually issuing their money, which I don't think they even wouldn't have been able to they couldn't have done what Hitler did, because they no longer really had financial autonomy, they set up a network of publicly owned banks. Well, they'd had these publicly owned banks they go back to the early 1800s, where they were just public banks that funded local business. That's what's good about the public banks. So anyway, they strengthened this public banking system, funded their small and medium-sized businesses, which became the number one manufacturer in the world. And this is a country that's half the size of Texas. And even now, you know, they're the obvious leader in the euro system, and that's why there's all this dissension, because Germany just didn't want to have to carry everybody. So there's the question whether they're going to bail everybody out or not, or whether they'll just revert to printing their own currency again, as Switzerland has done. There's all those issues going. So Germany had this very strong public banking system headed by the Landesbanks, which We have one, you know, the Bank of North Dakota. So let's say the Landis banks would be like the state banks, the big public banks, and there are 11 of those. And then under those are thousands of small public banks that service the local community. But they're also private banks. You know, they all work there together. I was just in Switzerland where my daughter lives, and they have public banks and private banks that are side by side, and nobody really thinks too much about it. It's not a big competition. You just have the choice. So the public banks allowed the economy to become very strong. But when Germany joined the EU does not like anything. The EU, of course, is controlled by their big private banks, like virtually everybody is. And so the big private banks did not like the competition from the public banks, which particularly when the big private banks got into speculating with the whole derivatives thing going on in the last decade. And they wound up losing a lot of money. And meanwhile, the public banks were servicing the manufacturing, and they were quite profitable. So the big banks, particularly Deutsche Bank, wanted to get some of that market. So they leaned on the EU to require the German public banks to give up some of their perks. In other words, they would no longer be guaranteed by the government. And they were no longer allowed to count them. I mean, just recently, they haven't been allowed to count their guarantees in this new, more onerous capital requirements that are being imposed on the banks. And so that naturally cripples them. Oh, and also they were required to produce profits that they didn't have to do before. I mean, their shareholder is the public. It's the local governments who weren't looking for profits. They were looking for a functioning banking system that would serve their local community. But now they have to think about profits, and so, or in the last decade, they've had to think about profits. So they wound up getting into some of these collateralized debt obligations and so forth that they lost money to. So the media got all over them for having lost money, whereas nobody pointed out that the big money was being lost by the big private banks, that those are the ones where the government really had to fork over to do a big bailout. So there's a lot of prejudice against public banks because everybody just wants to privatize. There's a big push to privatize these days.
Well,
so they're losing out, and the rumor is that, or the story is that they don't do so well, but they did perfectly well as long as they were allowed to operate as public banks.
It's amazing. The price of success, Ellen. You do too well, and of course the giant banks want as little competition as possible. Even the numbers of them around the world, every time we go through an economic crisis, they consolidate, so there are fewer of them. And of course, after the 2007 debacle that exploded in 2008, banking giants disappeared. Lehman, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, other banks. So the big boys get bigger, and that's what they've done. They cherry-picked the assets they wanted and maybe let the others just end up in the garbage pail. And the system just consolidates more and more. And I think the ideal system for all the banking giants would be to end up with a single private bank running the world, and you could call it anything you want, World Bank, mm-hmm. Neighborhood-friendly bank. That would be a nice name to disguise. The one and only world. You want to do business with a bank? You go to your neighborhood branch of the World Bank. What a system
that would
be!
You could call it the People's Bank. We own the people.
Well, I mean, they have everything their own way now. Just imagine how much more they have their way when there were a fewer of them consolidating to a bigger and bigger size. Ellen, when I first moved to Chicago with my family back at the end of the 1960s, the local bank close to me was called the Upper Avenue National Bank. They had two branches. I mean, they really were a neighborhood bank. I mean, here I live in downtown Chicago, and they really were a neighborhood bank. You could get to know the bank manager. I did. And, I mean, he even called me a couple of times when there was something he thought I ought to know. That's impossible mm-hmm. today. Well, that bank became a bigger bank. I think it became a Lakeshore National Bank. And then I think it became a Bank of Chicago. And then I think it became a Bank One, bigger and bigger and bigger. And I forget if there was something after Bank One, but that same bank today now is J.P. Morgan Chase.
From the Upper National Bank.
The Upper National Bank, Upper Avenue National Bank, Ellen, to J.P. Morgan Chase. Oh mm-hmm. my goodness! You think even the local manager would call me? Let alone, well, J.P. is long gone.
And those little banks are the state banks that for 100 years, or, I mean, well, I guess as long as we've had a banking system, have competed with the national banks. Well, we haven't had national banks except since the 1860s. And the national banks are the big banks with the national regulators that are just sucking up the whole system. But it's the little local banks that want to make loans to local business, the too big to fail banks. Don't make loans to local business. So even though it is said that there are all these $1.6 trillion in excess reserves sitting on the books of the banks, they sit on the books of the big Wall Street banks who are not making loans to small business, small homeowners, etc. So I've been writing a book on public banking, I've been researching public banks all over the world, and it's the same story everywhere. It's really interesting. They've done really well. They get suppressed, or you never hear about them, or they get privatized. Whenever they do really well, they get privatized, like the Commonwealth Bank of Australia was a great model. It got privatized. The Bank of Canada is still theoretically publicly owned, but the Canadian government is not allowed to borrow from them. The Canadian government has to borrow from the private banks, as if this would maintain a stable money supply, but borrowing from your own bank won't, because your own bank will just print the money. But what nobody seems to recognize is that private banks also just create money on their books.
Ellen, it's crazy to have a country where the central bank is a public bank, but it doesn't operate like a public bank. It basically lets the same kind of system operate in Canada as it does in America. And the Bank of England also, technically, the state controls the Bank of England, my understanding, or I think the way the wording is in their charter is the bank is beholden to the Crown. Well, the Crown doesn't have any power, you know, except, you know, the nominal power. But the government of England has the power. The government of the UK, they have the power. So you've got a nominally a public bank, but it doesn't operate like a public bank. I think the craziest system is the Eurozone, Ellen, where you've got a European Central Bank, ECB, and what is it, 27 Eurozone countries, I believe the number is. And they've given up their sovereignty to an outside financial authority. I mean, that is absolutely crazy. So they get into a debacle like they're in now, and you've got a system, the Eurozone itself, you've got a system of unequal partners. So you've got an economic juggernaut like Germany partnered with a basket case, Greece, and Greece isn't just a basket case now. Going back in its history, it's been a basket case, I think, at least several previous times. So Greece is effectively a corpse, and economic juggernaut Germany has to cough up money to pump air into a corpse. I mean, it's crazy. And the more air that gets pumped into it, the greater the debt of the corpse rises, and the corpse has to, somehow that corpse keeps functioning. I don't know how a corpse functions, but the corpse keeps taking it out on the people who live inside that corpse, raising their taxes, cutting their wages, laying people off. So the spiraling public debt spirals even higher. The revenues to the government get smaller and smaller. The corpse has to borrow more and more money. I mean, there's an end to this game, and it's not a good one, Ellen.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Let's take a quick break and we'll come back. on with Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt, discussing the merits of public banking. It's such a slam dunk case, Ellen. Again, every time it's tried, it works wonderfully. No system is perfect, but public banking compared to what plagues the world now, not everywhere, but unfortunately, certainly in most of the places where it matters most, it is just a cancer that has to be exercised. By the way, that comment during the break about October 2011 in Washington, that's called a Stop the Machine, occupying Washington, and they're concerned about all the big issues. I know people who were there, and some of them are so committed that they made statements, they made public statements, that they're coming. They began their mission on the 6th of October. Why that date? 10th anniversary of the illegal war of aggression on Afghanistan, one of America's many wars against a non-belligerent country, claiming they had some involvement with 9/11. They had absolutely nothing to do with it. Bin Laden had absolutely nothing to do with it. Bin Laden wasn't killed, by the way, by that theater that Obama pulled off. We've talked about that on this program. Ellen, Osama died in December 2001. It was virtually public information at the time, and I think some of the major media even reported it. Benazir Bhutto, a former prime minister of Pakistan, was interviewed on BBC on a David Frost program, and she said it very clearly that Osama died in December 2001. There were important people who showed up to his funeral. Mm-hmm. I don't think George Bush was there, but I think just the way the Soviets back in the 1920s when Lenin died, I think they wanted to keep the corpse going. Just the way we keep the corpse of Greece going today, Ellen. I mean Greece is dead; it's a corpse, but we keep pumping air into it. So Bin Laden's been gone all these years. All the videos and audios were fake. Some of them were bad fakes. It was so bad that the guy they had said was Bin Laden didn't even look like Bin Laden. And then after his beard turned gray, new video showed up with his beard a jet black.
He got younger, yeah.
We talk about the game that couldn't shoot straight. Anyway, I mean, this stage theater that had nothing, I don't know who the hell they killed, but it certainly wasn't Bin Laden. And it was a third-rate stunt. Just the way, I've got to get this in too, just the way they stunt, they try to pull off last week, Ellen. I wrote three articles on it. The first one I called, I'm talking about accusing Iran of a terror plot to kill the Saudi ambassador here. And my first article I titled, Iran Falsely Charged with Fake Terror Plot. I mean the plot, the way they spelled it out was so laughable. I don't want to go into it now, but it was so laughable that anybody with even a small amount of sense simply wouldn't buy this nonsense. You want one example, Ellen? We'll go back to public banking in Germany and the student loan scam that you wrote your other article on. But one of the things that the FBI claimed went on between the so-called provocateur who has been indicted, consorting with a supposed hitman in Mexico, who was a felon working as a DEA agent in Mexico. In other words, it was a con, it was a sting, and supposedly this guy who was indicted told this guy he had a cousin in Iran who was a general, and he called him on the telephone, and this general said, oh, that's a wonderful idea, why don't you go ahead and do this, kill the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. Now just imagine a high-ranking Iraqi general on an unsecured landline to Mexico telling his cousin, who has nothing to do with the government or military, oh, it would be a splendid idea to kill the U.S. ambassador to Washington. And, oh, by the way, do it in Washington.
It's rather like that passport that fell out of the plane in at the World Trade Center.
absolutely.
Impossible things, and yet as long as the media doesn't question them,
within hours after a major event, I mean, how would they know? How could they possibly know anything? I mean, when the cops investigate a crime that took place, I mean, the investigation could go on for weeks, and a lot of them end in a dead end. They never know who did it. So, I mean, a lot of unsolved crimes, and the crime of the century, they name the culprits within hours. Well, you know, they named Oswald pretty quickly after November 1963, and James Earl Ray, and Sirhan Sirhan, and I don't know what the heck Oswald did. He certainly—I mean, he was the patsy. He was the patsy, and the other two had absolutely nothing to do with killing Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. But you know, I mean, the big lie gets repeated over and over again, and people believe everything, even believing that private banks work better than public banks. You know, well, anybody who would read your book, Ellen, would realize what a big lie that is. But let's talk about the student loan racket, because I wrote about that too. And about a racket.
Your book, your new book that's come out, the Fleecing Wall Street. I think it's, or How Wall Street Fleeces America. I think that's great. You've covered a lot of great subjects, and you've got a lot of material in there. Great material.
There's a lot in it. You were very kind to endorse the book, and there's a chapter in it on the student loan racket, and you wrote
a one on public banking, which is great.
I'm sorry.
There's one on public banking, which is great.
Oh, there's one on public banking. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's got to be the punchline of the book. I gave it away.
Oh yeah.
Well, it certainly is the punchline of Web of Debt. You first you spell out the problem, and then you spell out the solution, and there's a lot of material in between, and part of the problem. I covered it in my book, is this scandalous student loan racket. Talk about your article, Ellen.
Yeah. Well, that's what, I mean, a lot has been written about how bad the student loan situation is. It's gotten worse because the excuse is that student loans have such a high default rate that the banks wouldn't carry student loans unless all the usual protections were done away with. So they have been. They don't get any of the usual consumer protections, including bankruptcy. So that means that, and when the student defaults, as they will do if they can't get a job, and obviously the job market that was promised to them when they went to school, I mean, the idea was that if you got a four-year degree or whatever, a higher degree, that you were assured a good job or a better job when you got out of school, and then suddenly there are no jobs there, and we all know it's Wall Street's fault, although, like you say, they can't exactly put their finger on it, but they know who did it. And so here they're stuck with these loans where suddenly as soon as they default, the interest rate goes way up, and the interest rate, it accrues even after default. And then they have all these high fees, and they can't get out of it. I mean, their wages can be garnished. They'll probably get a job that wasn't near as good as they thought they would get, assuming they get one at all. And now they've got their wages garnished for the student loan. I mean, they wind up going, they can't go bankrupt. So they basically just wind up in the streets or, you know, I mean, it just can ruin people. So it's really a horrible situation. So what do we do about it? So that's what I like to always look for is how can we fix that? Well, recently the Federal Reserve, you know, they're on QE3, and QE3 was a big disappointment to the market, obviously, because it immediately dropped. And so Ben Bernanke said, "Oh, well, we could do more. We'll do more. We're prepared to do more." But he didn't exactly say what. But then it was, I quoted Alan Blinder, who's used to be on the Federal Reserve Board of Advisors or whatever, and he said, well, they're talking about QE4, and that now the Fed is no longer going to be just buying long-term government securities like they were doing. Now they're going to go back to buying agency debt because that worked better, or buying consumer loans of different sorts, or I forget how he put it, but anyway, we're getting into Main Street type stuff now, which could include consumer student loans. So here's my thought, what they could do. There's another Fed study, recent Fed study, that showed that the money supply contracted. It was $20 trillion in the shadow banking system, which nobody ever reports on, and that's why everybody thinks we're in inflationary times. But the shadow banking system shrank by $4 trillion since September of 2008. So we've got a $4 trillion hole there. And then meanwhile, the traditional banking system, which is actually had less assets in it than the shadow banking system, only went up by $1 trillion. So you've still got a $3 trillion hole in the money supply just since the fall of 2008, which was not, or I guess it was March of 2008, but that was not a great year anyway. I mean, things were already slipping. It was 2006, I think, was the height of the, you know, the mortgage bubble, et cetera, and then everything started going downhill. So we still have this big gap in the money supply, so we need to put more money out there, even though most people think it's the other way. They think that quantitative easing is inflating the money supply, but we actually need to get more money out there in some way, just because it's the nature of our debt-based money system that it has to continually grow, it's a Ponzi scheme that has to be continually fed, and if it's not continually fed, then we fall into depression or recession as we have done. So anyway, here would be my theory. They could buy up $1 trillion of the Federal Reserve's they're not allowed to directly buy government debt. But let's say that I'm not sure if the Education Department counts as an agency or if they can issue what's called agency debt. But let's say they did. They are now actually in the business of student loans ever since 2010. And that was part of the health care bill. So the Education Department is issuing federal student loans. They could issue a $1 trillion bond issue to cover student loans. There's $1 trillion in outstanding student debt right now. They could buy up the entire student debt and reissue it at 0% interest and use much more charitable terms. For example, they would not collect until people had the money to pay. This is how it's done in Australia, and it works really well. And they wind up with some educated people who go out and get better jobs and generate more taxes and so forth. So we could do the same thing. So let's say you put out $1 trillion. Even if you have a 10% default rate, you're going to get $900 billion back. So you've only really put out $100 billion, which is only a seventh of what they put out for the bailout for Wall Street, which didn't do much. So if you put out $100 billion and the GI Bill had a return of 700%, in other words, for every dollar you put into it, you got $7 back in terms of they educated the GIs, so now they got better jobs, so they paid more in the way of taxes. They bought homes and other consumer goods, and there were inventions and businesses were funded through the GI Bill. All this stimulus through the GI Bill returned seven times the output of the federal government in terms of revenues.
You're really, so it was an extraordinary program, Ellen, including we had all these servicemen coming back from World War II. America had a military then of 12 million. Well, they were fighting a world war on two fronts. 12 million. I mean, there's a way to end unemployment, Ellen. I mean, we had this gargantuan unemployment at the end of the 1930s. It went down for a while and then went back up again. And you start a world war, and all of a sudden, not overnight, but unemployment gets completely erased. But you had all these people coming back after the war, and these wonderful benefits that were made available to these young people. The GI Bill provided it was a vehicle for young people and even some older people to get a college education. It was marvelous, and there was housing help. And it was an example of how to do things the right way as opposed to the way we're doing them now. And it paid off, as you said. I mean, it really was an investment that paid off many-fold, and it was a great period of prosperity. You know, this stuff doesn't get ignited overnight, but the 1950s, there was a recession or two in the decade, as I remember it. But basically, there was growth until things began unraveling later in the 1960s. But it was marvelous times, and all of this stuff can be replicated again today, but they won't do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, even Greece. I mean, we're living in artificial scarcity because we think we have to pay back all these debts, that it's all numbers, and we don't have the numbers. Well, but we've got the people, we've got the materials, we've got the brains, we've got everything that we need to invest in growth and development and abundance for everyone. I mean, we don't even need necessarily jobs. The whole social credit thing is, we need more leisure time, and we should be able to afford it. But we have this misconception about what money is and where we our status with money, and that we can't just put the money out there to do what we need. In fact, what money should be is little receipts from the government saying, we acknowledge that you have worked for us, and here's your pay, and go out and spend it in the community. It should be originated from the government. The government is the people, the representative of the people. The people acknowledge that service has been rendered or products have been delivered to the government. The government should be able to issue little paper receipts acknowledging that, and those are the money supply that go out and then circulate as money. But instead, we think money has to be borrowed first, as if money is a thing and you have to dig it out of the ground, or you have to find somebody who's willing to give up their little stack of receipts before you can have receipts. But the receipts are just evidence that you've done something for the government, which is for the people, and then that's where money should come from. And could come from. Even in Greece. Greece could solve its problem if it's allowed to just issue some receipts out there and get its people working again.
Absolutely. Well, of course, every country in the Eurozone is hamstrung under a common system that all of the countries have to abide by the rules of the Eurozone system. All countries have to abide by them. Well, I don't know what rule indicates that if a country says, well, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, and I don't want to be part of this system anymore. Even if the system says, no, you can't leave, you have to stay, you know, it's permanent, it's forever, well, then in diplomatic language, they can simply tell the Eurozone authority, go to hell, we're leaving. We're not going to pay the bankers. We're going to come back, and we're going to reissue the drachma, and we're going to have our own central bank, and we're going to run Greece for the benefit of the Greek people, not for the benefit of the French and German and other giant banks that want their pound of flesh before anything else gets done. It's okay to wreck the economy as long as the bankers get paid. Well, that's the system they have over there, and unfortunately, that's the system we have here, Ellen. So, you know, student loans, kids who take out student loans, they can be paying debt. They can be repaying back their debt when they get into retirement. They can have this social there won't be any Social Security by the time these kids retire. But if there was Social Security, they would have their payments garnished.
Yeah, so they've turned education into something where they can extract and exploit out of the kids. I mean, it's instead of turning it into an investment in itself, something that prepares people to go out and be highly productive and efficient. And you know, if you actually educate people for free, which is what you should do, if you get a sevenfold return on it, education should be free, it seems to me. You want people to be in this education system so they can become engineers, et cetera, that will figure out how to invent things that will make life easier for people, and then we can all work half as much and we'll still have the same abundance. I mean, the reason we can't do that now is that all the profits, instead of being shared among the people, the profits are drained off to the alleged owners of these businesses. I mean, that's another issue, but we need to set up we have a very extractive, exploitative, rentier type economy. I mean, I have to admit to being part of the rentiers. I own stocks and have investments, but that's the way our system is set up, that the only way you can pay for your old age is your money has to be making money. But there's a fundamental contradiction there. You know, money doesn't make anything. So really, we should have a profit-sharing cooperative system, and one of the perks of this system should be that it'll support you in your old age, so you don't have to have your money making money in some way that extracts money from other people who are actually doing the real work.
And we should have a system where if the Constitution says, as it does in America, it doesn't mean anything, but it says it, government of, by, and for the people, and the preamble of the Constitution, the opening line says, we the people of the United States. Well, unfortunately, the people that they really mean are not you and I, Ellen, and everybody listening to this program. The we refers to the privileged we. You know, that 1%, or maybe 0.1%, that's the we they're talking about, but they didn't say it that way. And as much as I admire some of the things that Jefferson did, he wasn't perfect, and he was a slave owner, among other faults, but he was the main author of the Declaration of Independence. But even he used code language, Ellen, when he talked about the inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, life, liberty, I think that's reasonably clear language. But what he meant by the pursuit of happiness was the right to own property, which today would be, real estate, stocks and bonds, commodities, whatever, property, assets that have value. His language, the pursuit of happiness. But he also despised bankers. You and I know that, Ellen. I mean, he called them more dangerous than standing armies. And Lincoln was more worried about the bankers that he wouldn't do business with than he was about the Southern army that he was waging war with. We don't have people around today to talk like that, let alone put their actions where their rhetoric is. The real problem, Ellen, aside from money, power, and private hands, is that we have a totally corrupted political system that designed this system for them and allows them to get away with it. And if anybody wants to change the system, You can't do it. That's the way it is, and that's the way it's going to stay. And why? Because the politicians are bribed to go along with it. They want to get reelected, and the power structure of the money power structure of the country, that's the bargain. That's the grand bargain. The politicians get not all of them all the time, but the politicians get reelected in return for the politicians doing what the corrupted power system wants, and the people, in a word, get screwed. We have to change that.
But I think there's a lot of, I'm quite encouraged by this Occupy Wall Street movement, because that is the people spontaneously saying that they specifically are not limiting it to a couple of demands, saying we want this and this. They're saying we have been taken advantage, we've been exploited and we know it and you all did it and you need to fix the system. But anyway, it's largely internet driven. So this is the other media, the public or the what do you call it anyway, the social media. I could envision a political party, an Occupy party. Hazel Henderson suggested Elizabeth Warren and Sheila Bair as the candidates, two women that are banker people that understand banking and that have taken the populist position. But anyway, I think there might be hope for actually having a political party that would have enough popular support that it wouldn't need the big Wall Street money to get out there
Let's hope so, Ellen, although one of the things that is on my hit list is getting money out of politics and breaking up America's duopoly power. America isn't a two-party state. It's a one-party state. It's the money.
But how do you do that? That's the question, unless you can just replace all those congresspeople, which takes another political party, it seems to me.
Well, there's a word for how you do it, Ellen. It begins with an R and ends with an N. It's called revolution. I don't believe in blood in the streets, but I believe in people saying, there was a movie at the end of the 1970s called Network, where a media guy stuck his head out the window and said, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And that message just started resonating. Oh, I think he said it in the studio. In the studio, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And the public picked up on that message, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And the people across America occupying all these cities, raving against Wall Street and all the other abuses, they're saying we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And my feeling is we have to stick by that, and we literally have to say we sure as hell are not going to take it anymore. And if you won't listen to us, then we're going to come and get you, and we're going to grab you by the scruff of the neck and throw you out in the street and put somebody in there in your place who will literally be give us a government off by and for the people, because we're simply not going to take this crap any longer. People committed to refusing to give in, and no compromise. Well, give us a little and we'll talk about the rest later. Final status issues are discussed right now. They're not discussed. These are the demands. This is the way it's going to be. And if you don't like it, you're out of the game and we're taking over. And we don't need thousands doing this, Ellen. We need millions doing it. We're all in this together. Oh, my goodness, we're out of time.
But it's a Gandhi revolution. I mean, it's a sit-down revolution, not a violent revolution. And I think that's the way it has to be. We can't do a violent revolution because they've got all the weapons.
That's exactly right. Stick with nonviolence, but absolutely be committed never to give in.
Yeah.
Never, never. Quitting is not an option. Winning is the only option. I'm in this. I'm in this. We're all in this. Ellen, we'll do it again next month.
Okay.
Many thanks.
Bye.
Ellen, join us next week, Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern. Make it a regular habit.